They're called frequently asked questions for a reason. Sometimes questions persist from generation to generation because of our shared experiences. Because despite our separation by time and space, we still identify with many of the same basic struggles, the same prejudices, the same desires, the same dreams. And we seek to find our way through the well-trodden paths of those that have gone before us. Other times, questions rise again and again from generation to generation because we don't like the answers we've received. We want different answers. In our text today, Paul will be answering questions from the church at Corinth. All of them are ancient questions, but some of them are still on the frequently asked list. Go ahead and meet me, if you will, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. We'll be in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 today. Those of you who were observant readers may have noticed last week that when we were in chapter 5, Paul mentioned a previous letter. In verse 9, he says, "I wrote to y'all in my letter not to associate with immoral people." So there was a previous letter. The letter that we have is not the first letter to the Corinthians. It's just the first one that we have our hands on. So we call it 1 Corinthians. But sometime in between that first letter and this letter, a letter was sent to Paul from the Corinthians, and they had some questions. And we're going to pick up with Paul's answers to those questions now, starting in chapter 7. Verse 1. "Now, concerning the things about which y'all wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. And come together again, so that Satan will not tempt y'all because of your lack of self-control. But this I say by way of concession, not of command. Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner, another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to widows, that it is good for them if they remain even as I. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion." This past week, amid all of the coronavirus panic, most of you have probably become familiar with the idea of social distancing. That is, deliberately increasing the amount of physical space between people so as to not spread the disease. Evidently, some of the married men in Corinth were beginning to practice their own brand of social distancing, which was really more of a distancing from the culture they lived in. Corinth was like the Las Vegas of the ancient world. I mean, as you all know, immorality was rampant, and much of it was associated with idolatry and temple prostitution. And these guys decided the best way to distance themselves from the sexuality that permeated their culture was to distance themselves from their ladies. They were thinking, you know, we'd be fine upstanding Corinthian Christians if it weren't for these women. A couple centuries later, the Desert Fathers thought a similar thing. There was a trend of people who wanted to live a life of solitude, of asceticism, and devotion to God, as though if they could just get away from the world, you know, really, if they could just get away from other people, then they'd be able to live pure and holy and devoted lives. And the problem was, they found, wherever they went, they had to take themselves along. Here, some of the Corinthians were promoting celibacy as the means of that spiritual life. And they're saying, you know, isn't it more spiritual to refrain from sexuality altogether? And Paul says, well, that depends. On what, Paul? Well, for starters, it depends on if you have a wife. You know, if you do, It's not very spiritual to give your spouse the cold shoulder. No, that's not sacrificial mercy at your cost for their benefit. That won't make you closer to God. What it will do is provide the devil with an opportunity. Your idle hands are putting an arrow in the devil's quiver. You know, you're giving him ammunition to use against you and to use against your spouse. He says, no, if you want to be close to God, you need to work on being close to your spouse. In fact, you need to view your relationship with your spouse as an opportunity to put your relationship with God on display. Because that's what marriage is. It is the temporal, visual representation of the eternal cosmic reality of the love between God and the community of faith. Marriage is the shadow that will one day give way to the reality. And now you might ask, what should that look like? Well, you're not going to find a picture of it in a magazine. You're not going to find it on a television show either. But fortunately, we do have a manual. We have 66 books, the Old Testament and the New, that inform us on how to put our theology on display in our marriage. And the better you know the story, the better your marriage can be. Because you'll have a much better idea of the character of God. You'll have a much better idea of how to represent love as you walk in this world with your spouse. Consider sexual intimacy, for example, since that is the topic here. Throughout the Old Testament, take Ezekiel 16 or take the first few chapters of Hosea, for example. Israel is depicted as the wife of Yahweh. And Israel is condemned as a harlot. For what? Worshipping other gods. For having communion with the gods of the nations. She is a spiritual adulteress. Now, if worshipping another god is equivalent to adultery, then that means that sexual intimacy is actually an image or a picture or a shadow of that special intimacy that we reserve for God in our communion with Him, in our worship. Now, knowing that, how is the relationship between God and Israel supposed to work in that regard? Could Israel up and decide on their own that they were going to abstain from worship? Would that improve their relationship to God? No. Could Israel decide to withhold worship until God did what they wanted him to do? No. How were they to worship? They were to offer worship freely and frequently. So Paul will say to the married couples in Corinth who represent that relationship, stop depriving one another. If you're married, you need to act like it. And it should be no surprise that Paul says that the husband and wife don't even have the authority to make that call. I mean, he's already made the argument we saw at the very end of the last chapter last week, chapter 6, verse 20. He says, you, the church, have been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. Just as the spiritual body that is the church belongs to God, the shadow, that is the physical body of the husband and the wife, belong to one another. Well, what if you're not already married, Paul? What if you're a single person? Is it more spiritual to stay single? Now, Paul will answer that too. He'll say, that depends. On what? Well, it depends on if, according to verse 9, if you have self-control. It is good to remain single and celibate. If you have the opportunity and you've been gifted that way, if you've been wired that way, well, how do I know if I've been gifted that way? Paul says that's easy because that is obvious. You know, if you have an eHarmony profile or if you find yourself making eyes at the barista in the local coffee shop, you need to get married. But if that's not you, if you don't have the desire to be married, if you don't have the desire for sexual intimacy, then enjoy the opportunity to serve God without distraction. Even as Paul does. He says, this is why I do what I do. And in fact, as we move forward, we'll find out next week that all of these questions are actually connected to Paul. They're accusatory towards Paul. You may recall we've mentioned that this letter is an apostolic defense. Paul is being examined. Paul is being judged. Paul is taking hits. And he's responding to those here. He's saying, look, let me tell you why I do it like I do it. And we'll see that next week. But for now, he says, if you've got an opportunity, since you're asking the question, I think that it's great to remain celibate if you're wired for that, if you're gifted for that. Now, what if you decide then that you want to pursue that life, but you're already married? You know, does our freedom in Christ free us to leave our marriage? Or what if I find out that I'm married to a person that is not very spiritual? Someone who is holding me back in my relationship with God? Can I leave my spouse to pursue the spiritual life? Verse 10. To the married, I give instructions, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does leave, she must remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife. Can we leave our spouses to pursue the spiritual life? Years ago, I visited a Hare Krishna temple in Dallas. It was for a school project. I got to talk with the young fella who was running things. He had a wife. He had a kid that he loved. He showed me pictures. He showed me their beach vacation. And he explained to me, though, that according to his belief system, desire leads to suffering, and that's bad. So his goal, the goal of his religion, was to free himself from all the desires of his life. That is, to rid himself of all of his material attachments, including his family, and to go off into the sunset on a spiritual pilgrimage to live out a life of asceticism. And as I listened to him, I couldn't help but think, what an incredibly selfish thing to do. Your wife and your kid have to sacrifice at their expense for your benefit so you can go do this spiritual pilgrimage that you desire. Also, you can pretend that you're detaching yourselves from desire. It's an ego thing. Now, I look here, divorce and remarriage, that's still a hot topic today, despite the fact that Paul says that, look, Jesus has already spoken on the subject. In fact, the Bible has spoken often and frequently about the subject. Its teaching is clear. Jesus' teaching is clear. Your freedom does not permit you to abandon your spouse. The married relationship is a binding relationship, and God hates divorce. Couples shouldn't divorce. But any time this question comes up, any time the subject around marriage or divorce pops up, people immediately want to ask, what about the exception clause? Well, there is an exception clause, but it's not the one that you think. It's the hardness of the heart clause. Jesus says the reason divorce was introduced, the reason Moses permitted divorce, was because of the hardness of the heart. But that's not how God set this thing up in the beginning. You know, if you're divorcing your spouse, you're pleading the hardness of the heart clause. What you're saying is, I have a hard heart, and I'm pleading for divorce on the basis of my stony, petrified, unforgiving, loveless, graceless heart. And Paul says, you know, if you want to plead that, go ahead. But don't take that stony heart of yours and get remarried to somebody else. you stay unmarried or you find forgiveness, soften your heart and be reconciled. Now, some will say, but I've already divorced and remarried. And in that case, God's grace is sufficient. Okay, if He can take what men intend for evil and use it for good, He certainly can take what we've done in our ignorance and use it. I mean, He's in the business of redemption. He can redeem our mistakes. He can fix our failures. So if you find yourself in a new marriage, you stay in that marriage. And God can and will use you there if you open your marriage up to it. But make no mistake, you know, the record is clear. God hates divorce. Now, what about mixed marriage? We already brought up the idea that someone could be married to a spouse that is pulling them behind in what they perceive as their spiritual journey. What if they're just unequally yoked altogether? What about a marriage between a believer and an unbeliever? This is certainly an issue that would have been prevalent in the Corinthian church when you have no believers and then Paul comes in and brings the gospel. And unless the issue is that both spouses, like Aquila and Priscilla, just come to know the Lord, now you suddenly have mixed marriages because one person has accepted the faith. What should they do now? Should they leave the unbeliever? Should they seek to marry a believer? Notice what Paul will say. It's 1 Corinthians 7:12. But to the rest, I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband, and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. For otherwise your children are unclean, but now they are holy. Yet, if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or the sister is not under bondage in such cases. But God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you'll save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you'll save your wife? Paul's saying, look, here is my word on the subject. This is not something that Jesus has spoke on, but Paul's word is authoritative. It carries the authority of God because he has the Spirit of God so that he can know the mind of God. Now he speaks the word of God. He says, if an unbeliever is willing to stay, then you stay. Be the conduit of God's grace in your spouse's life and in your children's. I mean, I think of Piper. Y'all know that I can't see Piper all the time. How else would she be introduced to the Word? Who will pray for her? Not a week goes by that David doesn't remember to put Piper on our prayer wall. Now the whole community is praying for this girl. Why? Because of her relationship to me and our believing family. Now in this situation, Paul says, look, if the unbeliever decides that they want to go, it's out of your hands. You're not to drag them along. You're not to fight them over it. God's called us to peace. And if they dissolve it, it's dissolved. Now, the main thing is this. Verse 17. Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each in this manner, let him walk. And so I direct in all the churches. This isn't something a unique stipulation for the Corinthians. This isn't a special restriction that Paul is placing on them. He says, this is how we teach it everywhere we go. You don't need to change your situation to be spiritual. You don't need to change your status to be close to God. If you're married, be a married Christian. If you're not married and you don't want to be married, be a single Christian. If you're a Jew, be a Jewish Christian. If you're a Gentile, be a Gentile Christian. If you're a slave, be a Christian while you serve. And Paul's going to be careful to say, look, I'm not saying you have to remain a slave. I'm talking about how to serve the Lord. If you can obtain your freedom, by all means, do it. That's very much better. But the question is, do you have to change then? Is there some status that makes someone more spiritual and someone less spiritual? Saying no. You can walk with the Lord where you are. The important thing is to walk with the Lord. Now, he's going to come to the next question, verse 25. Now concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give an opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. I think then that this is a good in view of the present distress that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Look at verse 28. But if you marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life. And I'm trying to spare you. Skip to verse 32. But I want you to be free from concern. The one who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But the one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But the one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, and how she may please her husband. So I'm saying these things for y'all's own benefit, not to put a restraint upon y'all, but to promote what is appropriate and secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. Now Paul is writing to a group of Christians in a time when it was not popular to be a Christian. It was to invite trouble into your life. It was to invite ridicule and beatings. It was to invite the seizure of your property and potential imprisonment or even death. And Paul is going to say here, in light of the present distress, verse 26, I think it's good in view of the present distress, in light of the situation, in light of the trouble that is coming, I want you to be free from concern. I think you're better off staying single and remaining solely devoted to the Lord. It's one thing to get hauled off as a single person. It's another thing to get hauled off and leave a family behind. And Paul wants to spare them from that sorrow. But all the same, he also wants them to be like him in his full devotion and full service to the gospel. Either way, he says, look, if you want to marry, you haven't sinned. But if you choose to remain single, in light of what's coming, all the better. Now, verse 39. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives, but her husband is dead. If her husband is dead, she's free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord, only to believers. But in my opinion, she's happier if she remains as she is. And I think I also have the Spirit of God. Now, when Paul says here that he has an opinion on the matter, he said the same thing in verse 25 regarding virgins. That's more than just an opinion. It's the same word translated judgment in the first chapter. Chapter 1, verse 10, when Paul says, all y'all need to agree. There needs to be no divisions. Y'all need to be made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment. There's your word. What Paul is saying, see, Paul has the Spirit so that he can know the mind of Christ, and now he's revealing the mind of Christ so that they can join him and be of the same mind and the same judgment. So verse 40, in my judgment, she's free to be married if she wants, but I think she's happier as she is. See, in the mind of Christ, I think that the widow will be happier devoting herself to the Lord. Now, chapter 8, concerning things sacrificed to idols. We know that we have knowledge. You know, knowledge makes arrogant, but love edifies. If anyone supposes that he knows anything, he hasn't yet known as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by him. We've heard it said before, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Well, Paul said it first. And what he's saying is really this. So you know something. You know, you've received good teaching, good theology. Well, that's great, but what are you doing with it? You know, what is the outcome of this great knowledge that you have? How is it affecting the relationship of the believers that you come into contact with? Are you using it to build them up? Or are you using it to prop yourself up? You know, kind of beat them down and show how much more you know, how much more sanctified you are than they are. He says, verse 4, "Therefore concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that there is no such thing as an idol in the world, and that there is no God but one. However," verse 7, "not all men have this knowledge. But some, being accustomed to the idol until now, eat as if it were sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled." He says some of these brothers out there don't know what you know, and they struggle when it comes to idols and meat sacrificed to idols, and they think there really is something to it. So, verse 10, "If someone then sees you who have this knowledge," you think that you know so much because you have this understanding of your place in relationship to the law or former things that you were worried about, and you realize, look, an idol is nothing. You guys who have this knowledge, when they see you dining in an idol's temple, will not their conscience, your brother, if he is weak, be strengthened to eat things sacrificed to idols? And through your knowledge, he who is weak is ruined, the brother for whose sake Christ died. And so, by sinning against the brothers and wounding their conscience when it's weak, you sin against Christ. You know, Paul's saying, look, my opinion on this is, when in doubt, don't. You're doing all things for the sake of the brother. He's really going to nail it down. Verse 9, he says, look, you got this liberty, these rights, this authority. Take care that this liberty of y'all's doesn't somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. Use your prerogative to restrict yourself for the benefit of others. Yes, all things are lawful, but not all things are profitable for the body. Remember? All things are lawful, but not all things edify the body. So notice how your actions are affecting those around you. Verse 13, "Therefore, if food causes my brother to stumble, I will never eat meat again, so that I'll not cause my brother to stumble." Now I know you cowboys are out there saying, thank goodness that nobody has a problem with meat around here. And that's true. But we do have folks that struggle with other things. This or that. You know what it is in your situation. And the question is, are we willing to limit then our freedom for the sake of others? Are we willing to limit our rights or our liberty in Christ for the weaker brother? I mean, do we even consider it? And shouldn't we? Now, we'll look at these two chapters, and we're going to have more questions as we come through, more questions from the Corinthians that Paul will answer regarding spiritual gifts and even regarding taking up an offering. He's going to hit to the nugget of what these questions are really about in chapter 9. We'll see next week. But when I look at these kind of questions, questions that still plague us in one way or another, I ask, well, what should we think about them? What should our answer be? There was a fad that was going around. It hit the youth group scene pretty hard from what I've heard. And it was based on a funny little skit titled, "Will It Taco?" And the premise, as I understand it, was this. There are things that seem good to us on their own. Take deviled eggs, for example. You might like deviled eggs. You may think that deviled eggs are the best finger food to hit the appetizer scene. But the question at hand, the main question, the only question that matters is, will it taco? That is, if you put deviled eggs in a taco, would you like it? Will it taco? Now, we looked at some of the Corinthian questions, you know, some of which I mentioned persist. Some things that related to issues that could be good, like take celibacy, for example. Marriage. But the issue behind all these things, whether in marriage or out of marriage, whether treatment of a spouse or a brother, the questions that often pop up are not the question that should be the question at hand. They're not the main question. They're more of a permission question. Can I do this? Do I have the right? Can I get away with this? They're the kind of questions we fight about with our Constitution. I deserve. I have the right. That's not the question at hand for the Christian. That is not the main question. And there's only one question that matters. And the main question, which should be a frequently asked question among Christians, is this. Will it edify? And that is, will it be profitable for those that are around me? Will it build up the body? Or will it just prop me up? Some things might be good in certain contexts, like celibacy. But in your context, will it edify?